say it all for you now, that you have to be able to see the whiteboard, and I can't guarantee the quality of Andy's handwriting or drawing, and so if you can't see this very well, you should move forward, and there are no laws saying that you can't sit as close as Ryan or Don are. They don't even bite, so you could even come and sit next to them if that be the case, too. You are fine where you are as long as you can see. If you can't see, move forward, and then you have no one to blame but yourself. So you can't blame me. Okay, thanks for coming this afternoon, and thanks for being here. We're looking forward to special thanks to Pastor Coyle for being here too with us and making the harrowing ride today through the snow to get here. We're excited for these sessions this afternoon, and then also to have you with us in the morning tomorrow and through into the afternoon too. So. On that note, come back tomorrow. If you're not used to coming to Sunday school, come to Sunday school. Or if you are used to coming to Sunday school, still come to Sunday school. 8:50, we're going to start in the morning again and with another session. And then Pastor Coyle will be preaching in the regular 10 a.m. service. And then we'll have a light lunch that you are all welcome to stay for afterwards. And then one more session, and we'll be out of here by 1 or 1:30-ish, somewhere in there. And that'll give you plenty of time to still get about 3 hours of Super Bowl pregame in. And so that should be good, I think, tomorrow also. I want to read some verses for you. I should, before I get started here, just one other comment. It's a little chilly in here. Shannon agrees. Okay. I'll take the blame for that one. One slight oversight there on our planning to get the heat cranked up here today. It usually isn't in here. But the heat is on, right, Harold? Yeah. Good. And so it will get warmer in here, I promise. But it's not right now, and it's going to take a little while. So thanks for bearing with us there. Okay. Why Jesus? Knowing Jesus. And the verse, I didn't put a ton of thought into this, but it's the verse that comes to my mind right away when I think about this kind of stuff and why this matters and why this is so important. It's John chapter 17, verse 3. The night before Jesus dies, he says, "This is eternal life." So if we're wondering why this matters, "This is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." It is our desire to know Jesus, and I am excited to spend time here tonight and tomorrow getting to know him a little bit better here through the words that God has given Pastor Andy to share with us. So let's open with a word of prayer, and then I'll turn it over to him. Father, thanks for this time. Thanks for bringing us out here and keeping us safe. I pray that you would give safety to anybody else that may be on their way. And for us as we leave later tonight, God, I pray a special blessing upon your word now that you have for us to hear and to read and to listen to. I pray that you would open our hearts to hear what you have for us. God, I pray that you would be with Pastor Andy as he shares too, and give him strength and wisdom, discernment, energy, excitement as he brings your word to us. So bless this time, we pray in your name. Amen. I'll let him introduce himself.
Okay, it is really good to be here. It's been a couple years, actually, since I've been here. Again, my name is Andy Coyle. My wife is Monica, and we have 5 children, 11 down to 1, and they didn't make the trip with me this time. We are church planters out in Rapid City, so we're about 2 years into our church plant there. Before that, I think a number of you know that we were missionaries in Ukraine, and we had started a Bible school there, and I taught full-time there we had 3 rounds of class. And then everything fell apart, which I think some of you might also know that too. Love what we're doing in Rapid City. I'd love to talk to you more about that, but there's really not a lot of time about church planting and how important that is. I also teach senior Bible at a local high school, and I'm actually teaching apologetics. And so I love apologetics. I taught that a lot in Ukraine. I kind of weave it into my messages and able to share with you today. You know, when you say apologetics, it's like saying the word theology. It's huge, right? And you say, oh, he's going to teach on apologetics. Well, that can mean like a billion things. You know, if any of you have read anything on apologetics, you know what I mean by that. And so we're going to kind of narrow some things in. But before I say that, before we get to there, I just wanted to mention that it was like 65 degrees in Rapid City this last week. just saying. If anybody's interested in jumping in a church plant, I would love to have you. So, okay, All right. I like to doodle, and my handwriting is pretty bad. I blame my father for that. And you probably won't be able to see it, but I'll use this a little bit, and we'll just go from there. What I want to do in these next four sessions, they're all going to build on one another. Today is going to kind of be a unit, and that's kind of an important unit. And then tomorrow is going to kind of be a unit as well. So Pastor Micah said you got to come to Sunday school tomorrow, and you really do. Otherwise, maybe the fourth session is not going to make a lot of sense. My experience with apologetics is that sometimes it can be really theoretical, and sometimes it can just be really like just a lot of knots and something that's kind of hard to figure out. I want this to be very, very practical. I want this to be very, very useful, and I want to give you tools that you can actually use and in your conversations or even in your own thinking. What I'm going to be sharing are things that have been a huge impact in my life and a huge aspect of what I teach and what I employ in my preaching and interactions with people. And I think that's just really, really key. You have a handout. I hope that's going to help you organize your thinking a little bit. As we begin, I want to just spend a very, very, very brief moment on that first section that you have in your handout. Why is this even necessary? Our world is very interesting. You all agree with that. You all see that. And I think it's important to understand where people are at today. And that's kind of what we're going to be doing today is unwrapping or unpacking our cultural baggage that all of us, every single one of us, deal with on a day-to-day basis. You know, what makes people tick? What are people thinking? What makes them do certain things? And I think to do that, we also have to understand how things have evolved in that way. And you see three words there. You see pre-modern, modern, post-modern. And this is going to be major broad brush stuff here, okay? Pre-modern, that's, you know, usually categories, people kind of, whenever the beginning was, up to 1658 BC, I mean, sorry, AD. It's kind of like post-Reformation. The main aspect, and I'm going to write here this, pre-modern, the authority was theism. I can't spell to save my life, and so you're just going to have to deal with that. My students make fun of me all the time. Theism. So there's a sort of a theocentric worldview. People appealed to religion for their authority. That was just part of the deal. Revelation was the foundation. And so that's just, you started there. So that's why when you read like the Lutheran Confessions, they don't have sections on defending the existence of God. They don't have sections on defending the reliability of the Bible because they didn't need to. Okay? Things changed a little bit later, roughly 1650 to about after World War II, and that was kind of the modern period. And you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened during that time. You had the Enlightenment, where the authority was no longer really theism. The authority was reason. It was humanism. So if you've studied history much, you know, it was science. It was the development of Darwinian evolution. That was the foundation. No longer was it this sort of revelation. No longer was it this sort of theocentric worldview. It was man. And man was this sort of crown of everything. And we could do anything. You know, the scientific revolution, all that kind of stuff. That kind of fell to pieces somewhat after World War II. And now we have this, you've all heard this before, postmodernism, which is sort of a thing and sort of not a thing. And that's basically the 50s till today. And the authority of this is basically you. It's relativism, which we're going to be talking about. Relativism. Okay? So, in other words, what I'm trying to get at here is that today, and these categories are not like perfectly separate. You know, in our world today, it's kind of like people are in this category. They appeal to reason, they appeal to science, and yet still we have a lot of this. And the reason why this is important, the reason why we need to start with this, is because many people in our culture today, it's like you have I don't have any space. It's like you have walls around yourself, okay? So if I go to an average person in America, maybe outside of classic Midwestern town, but even within that, even here in Fargo, let's say, there's going to be a barrier around them, okay? There's going to be like picture cinder blocks all around them that are built up, and they have all these different sort of ideas that they have put there as a sort of barrier to hearing or receiving or understanding words like Jesus, okay? So in other words, back in the pre-modern day, you could say words like Jesus, you could say words like God, you could say all these things, and they're going to be understood from the lens of this sort of revelation and theocentric worldview. In our worldview today, when we say words like Jesus, we say words like God, well, they can mean anything. And oftentimes, they do mean whatever you want, okay? And so it's important for us to understand that if you have a person, there's a wall that if we go after with the gospel, oftentimes it's just going to bounce right off. They're not going to have a clue what we're talking about. And I'm guessing we could all share situations like that where we've tried to share the gospel with somebody, and it's just like, well, that's great. I'm glad that works for you, right? That's a good thing that Jesus works for you, but this works for me, okay? And so we need to understand that. We need to understand what are the cultural barriers that are in our society that prevent people oftentimes from not even understanding what we're trying to say. I'm not saying that this happens all the time. This is obviously, again, painting with a broad brush. But there are certain barriers that are in our culture, in our world, that just don't flat out get Jesus. I have a confirmation student who, again, our church planting context is very different. So we have a ton of people from literally no background whatsoever. And I had a girl who's a neighbor of ours, who's a friend of my daughter's, and she's like, so who's Jesus again? Who's this guy? And just ask questions with literally no knowledge of anything. And I'm finding this oftentimes, and they have all this other stuff there. And so I think it's important for us to be able to understand what are these things, and maybe how to deconstruct them a little bit, so that we can simply communicate on a deeper level with people, realizing that we no longer live in a world that is a theistic world. All right? You guys understand what I'm saying by that? It's important for us to understand that, because oftentimes, I think, we in the church, we still operate like we're living 500 years ago, externally. We have our insider language, and we take our insider language, and we try to communicate in the outside world with our insider language, and it just bounces right off, and we don't get anywhere. Because our insider language is good, and it's important for us to use that so we can communicate with clarity. But when we step out of our circle, when we step outside of the walls, we jump into our culture, and just like that, we feel like we're getting nowhere because we're not understanding that we're actually stepping into an entirely different thought pattern, okay? And so today, what we're going to be doing is just kind of trying to understand what that is. I have found that in my life, and in my interactions with people and training them and working with them, is helping them to understand what are these and then how to quickly be able to see through them and to break them down so you can actually then communicate to take that next step. Because again, it's no good if I'm trying to talk to Pastor Mike, and he's not a pastor, but he's just a random guy in our culture, and I'm saying, hey, you know, Jesus loves you, has a wonderful plan for your life. He's like, who? Who's that? Right? Anybody had a conversation like that? If you haven't, you're going to, okay? And so then what do we do with that? What do we do with that, all right? Okay, so what I like to start with oftentimes is this aspect of truth, and that's what you have there. I'm just giving you two major contemporary cultural kind of foundations. There's others that we can spend time with, but we only have a short amount of time. And so for me, at least in my experience, and you might argue with me and you might think, oh, there's some others that are maybe more important to figure out. In my experience, practically now, not necessarily philosophically, but practically, dealing with this idea of moral relativism is absolutely essential. Okay? What do I mean by when I say moral relativism? Can anybody define that?
My definition would be different than yours,
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I like that. Good one. Yeah, so here. I'll write it down here. I'll just give it a... That's lovely. Okay, basically, all ideas are equal. That's very, very, very simple understanding. All points of view are equally valid. All truth is relative to the individual. It's your perspective. All moral positions, all everything, all truths are relative. They're to you, okay? So in other words, no system or no moral position, according to this view, is greater than another. It is not more true than another. There's no objective standard for truth. And so if I say abortion is wrong, somebody's going to flip it and say, well, that's your opinion. Okay. For me, it's wrong, but maybe not for you. Or we sometimes in the church, oh, no, I don't like abortion, but, you know, for someone else, that's okay. That's moral relativism, okay? That doesn't really work, okay? Has anybody ever said that to you? If you try to talk to somebody about anything, and they say, you know, but that's your opinion. You can't judge me for my opinion. Has that ever happened? Of course it has. I mean, this is like one of the most foundational, practical things in our society today is this idea of relativism. And sometimes we'll take it on not just a personal level, but on a cultural level. And if you can get a person sometimes to realize, okay, there's no such thing as moral relativism individually, but we can take one step back and apply it to our culture. And we'll get to that hopefully today as well. But this idea, all truth is relative, okay? Which is also it's an objective statement. That's a different thing, okay? Why is relativism attractive? In your experience with people, or maybe even you struggling with this, I don't know where you guys are all at. In your experience, why is this type of an idea attractive? Why do people just go for this hook, line, and sinker?
It doesn't require change.
Yeah, it's easy. Mm-hmm.
No conflict.
No conflict. What?
Accountability.
No accountability. You can justify anything, right? You can justify any behavior. You can justify any belief. What else? Yeah. No. You don't have to think at all, actually. You can just really do whatever. However, and I want you guys to write this down. There are some things that relativists cannot do, okay? And this is what I am hoping, one of those practical tools. And so as you are interacting with this issue, this is where the practical toolbox begins, okay? Because there are things that a relativist can't do. And so really, I am very, very strongly of the opinion and belief that there's no such thing as a moral relativist. It's purely theoretical. It's not real, okay? And I don't believe there's a single person in this world that is an actual moral relativist. They don't realize it, but they're not. And so our job then, or our privilege, is to graciously then point out that, you know what, you're actually not a moral relativist. There's no such thing as that. Just like there's no such thing as postmodernism. It doesn't really actually exist. It's all in our heads. It's just theory, okay? So there are a number of things that moral relativists cannot do. Number one, a relativist cannot accuse another person of doing something wrong. You want to write that down. A relativist cannot accuse another person of doing wrong. If I believe that my morality or that your morality is your perspective, it is all your personal definition, then I can never judge anybody's actions, right? I can't ever judge anybody's actions. In fact, it makes it impossible to criticize the behavior of anybody else. I mean, how could I criticize if everything is equal? So, I mean, slavery is perfectly fine if that's your opinion, right? The Holocaust is perfectly fine if that's your opinion. Rape is perfectly fine if that's your point of view. Child abuse, it's perfectly fine if that's your view. Murder, you know what? It's your choice, right? Who am I to criticize what you're doing? You see how ridiculous that is? There's not a single person that actually lives that way. And this is part of the problem with this view. No one actually lives this way. We are constantly critiquing people. We are constantly saying, you know what? That behavior is wrong. Our society does it. We do it personally. And so this idea that all ideas are equal doesn't even make sense. And if you actually are trying to be a consistent relativist, then you can't ever, ever criticize anybody of doing anything. Hitler and Mother Teresa, well, they're just as moral because both did what they thought was right. Right? Two. A relativist can never complain about the problem of evil. The problem of evil is a major, major critique against God. You know, if God exists, then how can there be evil? How can there be a good God if evil exists? Why can't he do anything about it? And it goes on and on and on. You can't complain about that. Why can't you complain about the problem of evil if you're a relativist? What do you think? There's no such thing as evil, right? How can there be such thing as evil if relativism is true? Because at the end of the day, everything's equal anyway. There's really no good or there's really no bad. Okay? Does anybody live that way? Let me ask you that. No one lives that way, right? No one lives that way. 3, a relativist cannot blame anybody or praise anybody. Okay? I mean, nothing is bad. Nothing is good. I can't say, you know what? You did a great job here. Way to help that neighbor of yours. Or I can't say to someone, you know what? You should have done better here. You should have helped that neighbor of yours in need. That doesn't even exist. Why would I do that? I know I'm going quickly here because we just don't have a lot of time. A relativist can't ever say something is just or unjust. I mean, how would our court system look like under this worldview? Think about that. Can you imagine the chaos that would ensue if we had no ability to say that was just or not just? I mean, we can't judge behavior, so if we can't judge behavior, then we can't ever punish anything wrong, and there can be no place for justice. 5, a relativist can never improve their morality. Most people in our society are trying to be better at something, right? I mean, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, or it's irrelevant. Part of the way that we are wired naturally is to pursue some sort of higher level of something, okay? That doesn't work within this, because at the end of the day, if what I am saying now is good for me, why would I try to get better? There's really no standard to get better by. 6, I know I'm going fast, sorry guys, ask me later. Relativists can't hold a meaningful discussion with anybody, okay? So if Ryan and I are trying to debate something that is moral, I mean, you turn on the news today, you turn on anything, and it's just constant debate, right? Regardless of the issue, if people are yelling and screaming at each other, that doesn't exist if relativism is true, because why would Ryan and I debate on something like abortion? I mean, what's the point? They're both true. So you can't even have an actual meaningful discussion with anybody because it's all subjective, right? And finally, you can't really promote the idea of tolerance. What is tolerance again? It doesn't even work. It doesn't even make any sense. Why would you tolerate anything? You only tolerate things you disagree with. You only tolerate things that you don't think are right. But if everybody's right, it just kills everything. So at the end of the day, this idea of relativism, moral relativism, doesn't actually even work. Is this landing at all? Is this making any sense? Okay, no, we just flew right through that, okay? There's not a single person that is an actual relativist. They might say they are. They're going to throw all these platitudes at you. They're going to say, you know, that's your truth, this is my truth. But they don't actually believe that. They don't actually believe that. One of the things that I told our students in Ukraine and what I tell my students now to do, if they ever get in discussions like this, and this isn't my idea, it's from somebody else, is to steal something of that person's. You maybe heard this before, too. It's like, so I'm just going to keep picking on you. So if Ryan is saying, you know what, that's your truth, this is my truth, whatever, I'm just going to take his phone and say, hey, thanks. What's he going to say? No, really, it works it's perfectly fine for me. I like it. Yeah. Oh, really? I can't do that, huh? Why can't I do that?
Because it's stealing.
It's stealing. Well, what's wrong with that? For me, this is good. You know, I kind of like this. I could probably sell this, make some extra money. I'm just going to take it. I'm a little bit bigger. Well, I feel like I could outrun you, so, you know, might... Might makes right, and so what I'm just going to take this, and there's really nothing he can do about that. Okay, obviously that's not going to work. He's going to say, you can't do that, and so I've just turned him into an absolutist, right? Because he is making a moral judgment on my behavior, okay? And so anybody that actually throws those theoretical ideas out, in practice they don't actually live that way. No one lives that way. And so it's not that hard, actually, to take this first cinder block down of relativism. Because all we need to do is point out that actually they're an absolutist, okay? So what is it? So oftentimes in today's world, that's easy to do. And someone says, well, "Okay, all right, I don't believe in personal subjectivity or relativism." But you know, we as a culture, we have an agreed upon morality. We have an agreed-upon morality in America that's sort of evolved over time, whatever, and that's where we judge those types of things. What would you do with that? That's really common, actually, today. How would you handle that? Instead of personal, it's cultural. What do you think?
Well, then the Germans were justified, because that was their culture.
Yeah, right, yeah. It's the same issue, really. So everything you just wrote down, it applies culturally. Okay? So no one culture then can say to another culture, hey, you shouldn't do that. In fact, actually, that's what the Nuremberg trials revealed after World War II. All these soldiers are saying, hey, we're just doing what was acceptable within our culture. We're just doing what we were told, and everybody went along with us, and it was fine. It was a culturally accepted kind of a thing. No, they were tried for crimes against humanity. And so if we try to say that our culture is simply, our truth or our morality is simply culturally based or culturally decided, all we're doing is taking this relativism and taking it one step back, and we still have no way to say anything. We can't complain against the apartheid in South Africa. We can't say anything about any sort of thing going on all around the world. We have no business saying anything. Well, no one lives that way. Our culture doesn't live that way. It's still a mess. And so again, no one actually lives this way. So when somebody throws this at you, I'm just drilling you on this because it's so relevant. You hear this all the time. It's the foundation of our TV shows. It's the foundation of your movies. It's the foundation of college, of everything. It's just everywhere. Relativism, relativism, relativism. Who are you to judge me? Whatever. This is my view, your view, all these kinds of ways you can do it. It doesn't work, okay? That's the dirty little secret. No one lives that way. Not a single person lives that way. At the end of the day, everybody knows whether it is something objective or not. If I say chocolate is my favorite ice cream, are you going to argue on me with that? Probably not, because it's not that big of a deal. It's a subjective statement, okay? If I say chocolate is my favorite ice cream, well, you might say, well, vanilla is my favorite ice cream. Well, we're not going to go to battle over that. It's a subjective statement. It's a matter of my opinion, okay? But if I say God exists, that's not a subjective statement. It's an objective statement. It's either universally true or universally false. Or if I say abortion is wrong, your opinion can't change if abortion is wrong or if abortion is right. Your opinion can't change if God exists or God doesn't exist, okay? And so as we start kind of applying our basic common sense to the area of morality and religion, we start to realize that actually it's not a whole lot different than every other area in our life. You know, we don't apply relativism to the streetlights, you know. We don't do that, but for some reason, we've allowed the church to sort of, and our culture to play the relative game with religion and morality. And yet it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Okay, you know, if I get pulled over by a police officer and say, well, you know, speed limit says 70, but, you know, for me, my truth is that it was 85. What's the police officer going to say? Sorry, bud. If I write on my math test, you know, oh, well, for me, that answer was 7. The teacher says, sorry, you're wrong. It doesn't work. And so all we need to do then is to compassionately show that that same standard applies to areas in our actual beliefs and morality. The same thing. Okay, pure relativism is a figment of your imagination. All right, I want to take it one step further. First off, any questions? You got to raise your hand and just start asking questions. Otherwise, I'm going to go 100 miles an hour because this is a big topic. Anything, any question about that? Because I want to take it one step further. You all with me so far? Good. All right. Just for yourself, sometime if you're really excited about this and you want to go a little deeper, your assignment, figure out where relativism came from. What's the worldview underneath that that produces that? And that'll be some fun for you. Because relativism is actually an evil stepchild of something, okay? It didn't just sort of happen. It's actually part of a bigger framework. What I want to do now is take that relativism and apply it to religion. Okay, so we've talked about how it applies to morality. I want to apply it to religion right now. Anybody ever heard of the word religious pluralism before? Religious pluralism? Yes? No? There are multiple ways to God. You heard that before? You know, Hinduism or Islam or Christianity, you know, they're all kind of unique expressions of the same path. You heard that before? You know, who are we to judge a person who grew up, you know, in the Middle East with their religion, Islam, and whatever? You know, I grew up here in America, and so, you know, I'm a Christian, but who am I to judge someone over there, or maybe someone who grew up in India, or maybe who grew up in their reservation in South Dakota with their NAR religions? You know, who are we to judge? Because ultimately, you know, they're all just kind of similar things, paths to some ultimate reality. Heard that before? Yeah, that's called religious pluralism. All that is relativism applied to religion, okay? Relativism applied to religion. So basically, if moral relativism is that all ideas or all points of view are equally valid, religious pluralism is all religions are equally valid. All religions are equally valid. Anybody see that movie a few years ago called The Life of Pi, or The Life of P, however you want to say it? Anybody see that one? Yeah, so that's religious pluralism. You had this, yeah, it's an interesting movie. I asked my students the other day about this, and they said, oh yeah, I saw that. I'm like, so what was that movie actually saying about religion? They're like, I don't know. They didn't get the connection that you had a guy saying that, you know, there's aspects of Hinduism and Islam and Christianity and sort of just taking some here. Oh yeah, that's true there. Oh, we'll take the truth out of that one, we'll take the truth out of that one, and we'll just sort of merge them all together, and that's this sort of spirituality. Okay? That movie is like a test case for religious pluralism. All religions are equally valid. The mere existence of a religion then guarantees that it's true. So I can say, you know what? I believe in a cheese sandwich God on the moon. And that then also is equally true or worth believing in just because I say it is. Okay? Religious pluralism. You guys ever dealt with this? You guys are a little quiet today. So, somebody say a story where this came up. We gotta drive this home. This has to land in your life, otherwise it's meaningless. Give an example, somebody.
So I've got a coworker at Costco, an older gentleman who is Kurdish Iraqi, and he's a faithful believing Muslim. That, you know, for him it's not nominalism. It's real. And so he and I like to talk about God, and we like to talk about how everything that we have is thanks to him, is thanks to God. And so when the opportunity comes up for me to draw a distinction and that we're not talking about the same God, he kicks back against that idea, because for him, he views me as being a faithful Christian, and he sees admirable qualities of the Christian faith, and he just wants to believe that we are truly believing the same God.
Okay. That's a good illustration of our desire. And that's kind of the way people are. It's like we always want to believe the best. And so we see that devotion, and we say, oh, you know, it's so admirable, and oh, there must be true. And if we take one step back, well, maybe that's just the way it is. Maybe these are all just sort of culturally created religions that just sort of all have their own piece of the truth. And at the end of the day, everybody's going to end up in heaven anyway, because, well, they're faithful to that system, and I need to be faithful to my system, and all this kind of stuff. Okay, that's relativism applied to religion. What do we do with that? This is so relevant, guys. So relevant. There's three ways to deal with this. And I have that on your sheet here. These are so simple to remember, too. That just, again, provide clarity. So again, this first day, all we're doing is simply providing clarity. All right? We're providing clarity for our own thinking, and we're providing clarity so that we can understand where other people are at, why they think certain things, and how do we even navigate within that sort of category, okay? Three things here on what to do in communicating with a pluralist religion, religious pluralist. Number one, as you see here, number one. World religions are fundamentally different. That's the first kind of component here, all right? If all major religions are expressions of the same reality, wouldn't there be some similarities? However, there's like fundamental differences at their core. I mean, they sort of divide on like major issues, like the nature of God, for example, or the source of revelation, or what's the problem in humanity, or how do we fix the problem in humanity? I mean, even go a little bit deeper. Look at just the nature of God. What does monotheism mean? One God, okay? So even looking at the monotheistic kind of religions out there, the big three, you've got Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Do they teach the same thing about God? No, not even a little bit. Islam and Judaism, God is singular, and he's personal. And then all of a sudden, Christianity, God is three, and yet he's super personal in the person of Jesus. Okay, so those are fundamental differences. Hinduism, Buddhism, you know, you've got tons of them. Or this new spirituality, you know, is God one or is he three? Is he 300? Is he 3 million? Is he a tree? Am I part of God? You see, so like the world religions are fundamentally different on the key questions of religion. I mean, there's just really no argument about this. How about the human problem? So if they're fundamentally different about the nature of God, how are they fundamentally different about the problem that's inside of man in our world? Okay, I mean, a pantheist will say, well, you know, we've just forgotten that we're part of God. Okay, we lack this enlightenment. Islam says that sin is just, well, it's just weakness. It's willful disobedience. It's not something that's inborn. Christianity says, no, sin is inherent in the human condition, right? So how do we fix it then? Is it faith? Is it obedience? Is it meditation? Is it knowledge? And you can go on and on and on. If you've studied world religions, this isn't a secret. It's not a surprise. Is that if you start comparing all the world religions, or even the smaller religions, I mean, they are fundamentally different. Fundamentally different on all the major, major, major things. Just, how can they be the same? That's the first key. You know, and as you're talking to somebody, this isn't going to be controversial. Unless I don't know this. And again, that might be the case. Again, and we live in a soundbite culture. You just sort of hear something that sounds kind of good and you just sort of throw it back and you don't have a clue what you're saying. And so sometimes people throw these things back and they don't really understand. And so you might be dealing with a person that honestly doesn't know that there is fundamental differences within the nature of religion. But this is the first step, foundation, okay? The second point here, world religions are irreducible. What does it mean to reduce something? What does it mean to reduce something? To make it smaller, to break it down, right? There is kind of an idea in our culture that says, you know, if we just sort of reduce all the world religions out there to its kind of lowest form, there's going to be this beautiful consensus that emerges, this basic general agreement that's going to emerge, okay? You know, it's kind of like if you reduce a Ford, Chevy, and a Dodge. Yeah, they might look different, they might operate different, but you know, they all have an engine, they all got tires, and they've got all of these similar things. They try to use that then to say that, well, if we all sort of just break it down to, you know, just love everybody, then we have this consensus. That doesn't work, okay? It doesn't work. The problem with religions is that is simply not true. At the core of all the religions in our world today are completely different foundations. I just mentioned that. You have completely different things. You know, to try to break it all down like to this, it doesn't work. Because again, if you break down the world religions, this is what you're doing. Okay? They have a different view of God. They have a different view of the world. They have a different view of reality. They have a different view of the problem. They have a different view of the solution. I mean, they're just absolutely everything. And so you can't reduce these to a basic consensus, because if you reduce them, they're all starting from a different place. It's kind of like reducing a car, a cheeseburger, a house, and a cloud. Okay? I mean, even that illustration breaks down because it still matter, right? So religions are so diverse in belief, in worldview, that if you were to reduce them down to their lowest form, well, they don't even exist anymore. What's the point? You're going to hear that. Oh, we need to understand and tolerate other religions, because really, you know, they're just like ours. If we just sort of break them down and go to the lowest form, you know, love people like yourself. Okay? That doesn't work. Try it. Try reducing religions down to their core. You're going to find different, completely different foundations, which was the first point. So first point, world religions are fundamentally different, which means that they all can't be the same. Number two, world religions are irreducible. But the third point here is the most important. And this, I think, makes the most sense. World religions are contradictory. Anybody studied any logic here? You ever studied logic? A few of you guys? Well, but you all know logic. You might not have studied formally, but you know it. Okay? You know that I can't be flying and walking at the same time. Right? I mean, of course not. You know that. Or here's another example. Let's say that I'm in Sioux Falls, and I run into somebody, and we start visiting, and we realize that we both know. No, let's say this. Okay, let's say that I'm talking to somebody in Sioux Falls, and I say, oh, I'm from Rapid City. Oh, hey, I know a guy in Rapid City. His name is Nathan. I'm like, I know a guy in Rapid City named Nathan. Wow, neat. Well, the Nathan that I know is 20 years old. The Nathan that I know is 20 years old. Well, the Nathan that I know loves football. The Nathan I know loves football. The Nathan I know loves going to McDonald's. The Nathan I know loves McDonald's. The Nathan I know goes to the School of Mines. Oh, the Nathan I know goes to Black Hills State. Are we talking about the same person? No. Okay? That's called the law of identity. And that's what you want to use for within Islam, okay? And the difference between gods. The law of identity. If there is any one difference between two different things, they can't be the same thing. We know instinctively that that's true. We use these laws all the time. We apply these in our lives all the time, okay? That also relates to how we view religion, okay? Does it work for you to say that red means go if you're driving? How does that work? Can go mean both red and green? How would that go? Not so good, right? All right, so if we apply some basic critical thinking to this whole discussion, and we've already established that they're fundamentally different, we've already established that you can't reduce them, but the third point is simply applying some critical thinking, okay? They can't all be true. All right? Something can't be and not be at the same time in the same way. I can't turn left and turn right in my car at the same time. Have you ever tried that? Can you do it? It doesn't really work unless something's seriously wrong, okay? You can't jump and not jump in the same way. So let's apply that to religion then. The essential beliefs of all these faiths, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Hinduism, they're fundamentally different. And they fundamentally contradict one another. Even the religions, again, that hold the most in common, like Judaism and Christianity and Islam even, they take positions that logically clash with one another. They contradict one another. In Christianity, Jesus is God. He's the Son of God. In Islam, no, Jesus, he faked his death on the cross. He was just a prophet. In Judaism, of course, he's not God. All right, that's kind of a big deal, isn't it? So you have three religions that are contradicting one another. I mean, basic elementary logic tells me that Jesus can't rise from the dead and not rise from the dead. Right? He can't both be God and not God. Right? Are you with me here? Okay. At the same time, in the same way. God can't be one and 3 million at the same time, in the same way. That doesn't work, okay? Basic critical thinking tells me that. God can't be 300 million, me or a tree, at the same time, in the same way. We know that, instinctively, we know that. The problem can't be that evil is an illusion, or that evil is sin in us in the same way, in the same place. It doesn't work that way. We can't be both created and evolved from soup at the same time in the same way. It doesn't work. Okay? So if you apply that first step of fundamentally different, and you just go down those lines, and you start looking at how all these world religions classify things, you realize that they can't be all true. They contradict one another. They can all be false. Okay? They can all be false, but they can't all be true. Does that make sense? That's really, really, really important. Again, religious pluralism, if you guys are still with me here, religious pluralism says all religious ideas are equally valid. Even just basic kindergarten logic tells you that can't be true because they contradict one another. They contradict one another. Allah and the God of the Bible, to pick up on your illustration, they can't be the same. The law of identity tells us that very, very clearly. Okay, you start lining up the characteristics of these things, and you clearly realize after a while there might be some similarities, they're going to clash. And if there are differences, they can't be the same. Are you guys with me on this still? You're so quiet. It's just hard. Yeah, there we go. So, thank you. Okay, say that again.
So, you know, Christians like to say there's Christianity saved by grace, and then there's religions saved by works. And sometimes it can come across as a little simplistic. And so I'm just wondering how you would compare that to the irreducible nature of other worlds.
Okay, I think that's a theological position. And so, like, if I look at natural law or natural revelation. Okay, so I'm going to, without any sort of specific revelation by God, and I'm only thinking natural religion, I'm in the middle of a jungle somewhere, regardless of whatever, I'm going to sense there's something out there that's divine, that's all-powerful. I don't know what that is. I can't actually articulate that, but I'm going to naturally think appeasement mode, just because that's how we're wired naturally. Okay, so, but that's a theological statement. So then, as I start looking at some of these other religions that are designed and flow from natural revelation, that's where that idea comes. And it is overly simplistic, and yet at the same time, if we understand the thought behind it, looking at this appeasement understanding of natural revelation, yeah, I think we can go for that. Now, but when you actually start processing the actual specifics, then you start realizing all the differences, and that would tell you. So even though there might be a similar thread theologically, the components of those religions are completely different. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. I just want to make sure myself that if I'm having a conversation with someone or a group of people, that I can maybe use the knowledge of the basic theological consistency, use it in my mind, but maybe respectfully allow them to express the differences between their own faiths.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so that brings up a lot of good aspects there, and I think we're going to try to bring some of that in into our next session, too. How do we apply all this, you know? And I know you're just sitting there, you're taking it in, maybe this is a review for some of you, maybe you never thought about this before, maybe you know all this, or maybe you whatever. How do we actually take this and apply it into a conversation? And that's not just knowledge. There's an art to it. There's a wisdom that goes along with interacting with people. But at the same time, if I interact with people in our world today, in our culture, and if I interact with people thinking that I am living in a theocentric or a theistic worldview, and if I start using my insider language without even having a clue where they're at, man, I'm just going to run into a wall left and right. I'm going to just strike out left and right. I'm not saying, please don't understand, I'm not saying that God can't use that and he can do miracles because he creates faith through his word. I get that. But there is a sense that there is a pre-evangelism that is needed for so many people in our culture. And that is what this is. It's sort of a pre-evangelism. This isn't going to save anybody. All this is doing is taking down some barriers. And if I can sort of artfully help this person think a little bit more, I am helping them tremendously. And then I'm also creating credibility to be able to share then when I strike this down. That's what today is going to be. We're just working, building this down. I mean, sorry, not building, tearing it down slowly. We're not even talking about Jesus today, actually, guys. Can I say that? You know what I mean by that. Okay, that's going to be tomorrow, okay? Because, I'm convinced that there's this wall. And again, this is a generalization, but people have this wall. And if we don't understand that, then it's just, we're struggling. Yeah.
So, in a conversation with somebody, you just get to know.
Yeah.
But there's questions to ask to find out what you're looking for.
Yeah. Has anybody heard of the curriculum called Tactics? This is like, no, I would totally recommend this. It's from Greg Kokel. Anybody ever heard of Greg Kokel? He's the president of Stand to Reason. Now you've heard of him, yeah. He actually just wrote a book this last year. It's called The Story of Reality. And many people, I'm using it with my students right now, many people say that is the modern Mere Christianity book. It is phenomenal. But anyway, Kokel's been on the radio for 30 years, and he deals with everybody for 30 years, and he's developed a program, and that's what he's sort of, it's called Tactics, okay? So I would so encourage you, we went through it with a small group at our church. It's extremely accessible. But basically what it is a series of three questions, and you can do it on anybody at any level. That's the genius of it. So, for example, if I'm talking to somebody, and let's say, I'm just going to keep picking on you. Do you have any tattoos? Let's pretend you do. Okay. Let's pretend you've got a tattoo on your arm, whatever. And I say, hey, what does that mean to you? Okay. So the first question is, what do you mean by that? You can ask that many ways. What do you mean by that? So whether a person actually is saying something, whether they're making a claim, the key thing here is that we allow them to try to defend themselves. That's the beauty of this method, is that we don't actually tell anybody much of anything. We let them try to explain themselves, and most realizing that most people can't. And so I want to hear his explanation of, let's say if it's a religious symbol. And now if I know it's a religious symbol, I want to see if he knows it's one and what that even means for him. And so I'm going to ask him, hey, what do you mean by that? I had that conversation with a gal giving me a haircut a few weeks ago, and she actually had a Trinity symbol on. I'm like, hey, you know, What made you do that? What do you mean by that? Oh, it's a symbol of the Trinity. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know. That's really awesome. And we had this interesting conversation. But just simply, if a person says, you know, I believe that is your morality, you can decide that. But for me, this is it. Well, I want to ask a follow-up question. Well, when you say that, what do you mean by that? Or what do you mean when you say the word God? Or what do you mean by this? And you're simply letting them explain themselves. You know, like what you're saying about allowing them to speak. Because oftentimes we in the church, we just start blabbering our mouth at people, not allowing them to share what's on their heart or what's their background or what do they think. We just naturally assume that we know better than they do about everything, or that we know what they think because we might sort of pigeonhole them. So important, number one, let them speak. Let them share who they are. Let them share what they mean by whatever issue you're talking about. And you could apply this to anything, really. Okay? And so that's that first elementary thing. This is the easiest question you can ask. Well, I'm interested. Tell me more. What do you mean by that? You just sit back and you're listening. Second question, how did you come to that conclusion? Or another way to say it is, why do you think that's right? You know, if a person just gave me some sort of a explanation on what they believe about something, well, my natural question is like, oh, that was really interesting. How did you come to that conclusion? Is that an offensive question? No, of course not. Oh, that's really interesting. Why do you think that's right? And all of a sudden, now you're going to start to see their rationale for it. Many people might not even be able to give you that much, though, okay? And so these are ways that you're asking questions, you're gathering information, and that's then how you're deciphering where they're at, okay? The third step is where it gets a little bit tricky, because the third step then is basically, as you're listening carefully, and you're listening for ideas that are contradictory, you're listening for all kinds of different things, and that's what the curriculum teaches you to do. Because these first steps, anybody can do this, you don't need to know anything to ask these two questions, right? I mean, you literally don't have to know anything about anything to ask these two questions. The third step is that you actually have to know something, okay? So you have to know what to listen for. You need to know, like, then what to do with what you're listening to, okay? So, however, let's say Let's say we're having a conversation. Say, oh, that's really great that you're a Christian. You know, I'm a Muslim, and you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, I think we all agree with one another. We're going to the same place. Oh, really? What do you mean by that? And then he's going to try to explain that. He might not explain that very well because clearly already he's not a devout Muslim, right? So I want to see let him figure that out. Okay. And then after he tries to explain what he means by that, I'm going to say, oh, really, that's interesting. How did you come to that conclusion? And then he's going to trip up even more, okay? So I'm just sitting there listening, and I want to hear what he's got to say. And then from that point then, I'm going to ask some follow-up questions that are simply going to try to expose that. However, let's say that I know nothing about Islam. I know nothing about logic. I know nothing about everything. I've already done him a great service by simply forcing him to explain what he believes, right? Isn't that already like a big step for him? Because clearly he probably doesn't know how to articulate that. So even by forcing him to explain, why do you believe that's true? Maybe there's that stone that's already been put in his shoe that makes him think, huh? That sounds kind of weird. I don't know. But that third step then, again, it's you're listening for contradictions, you're listening for things, and then you're asking follow-up questions. So I highly recommend this, Tactics, Greg Kokel. You can get a book. It's about that big. There's a DVD curriculum. It's even better. He teaches it all himself, and you've got a workbook to go with it. I think probably one of the best curriculums I've ever gone through or processed because it's so simple, it's so practical, and it's so non-threatening. And the theory behind this and with this material is that he realized, Greg Kokel realized, that he always felt the pressure that every conversation he had with someone, he had to seal the deal. I got to get this person to sign on the dotted line of Christianity. If I don't, I failed. He said, this is the pressure sometimes we in the church put on. This is sometimes the pressure that we put on you. You need to go out there and you need to get people to sign on the dotted line for Jesus. Pray that prayer and whatever else things. And he's like, wait a minute here. Maybe in certain people that works. But we also realize we live in a world that is surrounded, people have these walls of ideas. And so then he developed this program. All right, I think it's going to be really good to just start breaking down these walls. And then I can entrust this person to someone else who's going to come in and share the gospel. That's kind of the idea. So that's kind of an artful method. Pastor Kwanbeck, about that, I would really recommend that. It's so good. Kokel, K-O-U-K-L. Kokel. Greg Kokel. He's got a book on relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Thin Air, and his tactic books, and then his newest book, The Story of Reality, which is, if you're interested in getting a book on this kind of stuff, I think that's the best place to start. It is so well written. It's very accessible. Yeah, there's a pattern question, but I'm forgetting it offhand. But it's there's a line where you need to start knowing something, and so that's for you and your friend, that's where you start studying more about Islam and you start learning what to listen for. Because a lot of times people have statements that are, well, he uses the idea of suicidal statements, statements that kill themselves. So if I say all truth is relative, well, that's a suicidal statement because it's an objective statement, kind of a thing. Anyway, that's another topic. Okay, 5:30? Okay, so again, the first session, I threw a lot of stuff at you, and there's a lot of other ideas, but these are just some cultural baggage that people have in our world. Whether we like it or not, we have to understand that people outside of these walls, outside of the insider language, have different ideas. And they have different ways of viewing morality and different ideas of viewing religion. And we need to understand how to navigate so that we can actually then communicate. Okay? All right. Break time. Right? Okay.